Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music from the Commodores in conversation with original and current member William King. The Commodores will be in the region soon. More on that later in the program. First, we have a book described as part noir thriller and part romance and stars Vice President Joe Biden and President Barack Obama as detectives stumbling onto a mystery. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us now is New York Times bestselling author Andrew Schaefer. You may know Andrew from some of his previous books, 50 Shades of Earl Grey and The Day of the Donald. But today, Andrew is here to talk about his latest book, Hope Never Dies. Thank you for joining us again, Andrew.
All right. Thanks for having me, Emmanuel.
You're welcome. Andrew, how long have you been writing satire and parodies?
Oh, my gosh. I've been writing satire and parodies since I was a kid. I remember I wasn't the class clown, but I was the kid who would write humorous stuff to be passed around in class. The first thing I remember was like a Justice League of America parody.
Wow.
And I had written this and passed it around in the back of class in like the fourth grade, and kids were giggling and laughing at it and stuff. And I realized there was a way to make people laugh that, unlike the class clown, I wouldn't necessarily get in trouble for.
Did the teachers appreciate it?
You know, it wasn't quite as much of a distraction, so they were just kind of like, do whatever you want to do. And I had a lot of encouragement. If they had actually read what I was writing, some of it was pretty filthy for a fourth grader, so I'm glad they didn't actually check it out.
Wow.
It was filthier than the stuff I write now. Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness.
Wow.
I was a bad kid.
Okay. Well, speaking of filthy stuff then, will you tell us a little bit about your previous works, 50 Shades of Earl Grey and The Day of the Donald, and how you were inspired to poke fun at the people you write about?
So when you're writing a satire or parody, you have to parody or satire something that's really big, and it has to be something that's not been parodied to death at that point. So 50 Shades of Earl Grey I wrote while 50 Shades of Grey was kind of blowing up, and it was just a fun sort of, it was almost a defense of the romance genre.
Right.
Because I felt that 50 Shades of Grey was not that well written. I knew a lot of other stuff that was great that deserved a wide audience, but for some reason this was the book that was getting all the attention.
Right.
And I felt like, I was a romance reviewer at the time for a magazine, and I felt that I was like, there's a lot of great stuff that's not getting its due. And so it was a pleasure to mock this book that was really huge. You know, E.L. James did not enjoy it, but a lot of other people certainly did. And then for the next satire that I did, which was The Day of the Donald, was about a Republican reality television host who becomes President of the United States. Who could ever believe that?
No one. No one.
I know. And it was released during the Republican primaries of 2016, and it really did not find its audience, I don't think, because it took some shots at both conservatives and liberals, and it sort of split things down the middle. And I hadn't realized, you know, how partisan politics had become at that point.
Oh.
And I was still, you know, I was like, oh, this is great satire. It's just mocking these politicians. And people were like, how dare you mock Hillary? I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. I thought we were still doing the make fun of politicians thing, you guys.
Right.
But we weren't.
Wow. So there was very little humor on their side as far as you writing this book?
As far as Day of the Donald, I don't think either side really found it that funny. And besides myself, I found it hilarious. But, you know, as a writer, you tend to be a little bit more, I don't want to say aloof, but you can't be too much of a party guy.
Yeah.
You have to be somewhat aside from the politics. And, you know, and I don't have any problem saying, oh, well, you know, I did vote for Obama and Biden in 2008 and 2012.
Right.
I did not vote for Trump, but, you know, I was never really the flag-waving type Democrat, you know. And I realized, though, that less and less, though, you know, everybody's sort of sorting themselves into sides and camps. And so for this book, Hope Never Dies, which stars Obama and Biden,
yeah,
you know, the weird thing about it is there's actually very little politics in it. There's a few jabs here and there, but for the most part, it's just a story about, you know, two guys who used to be friends and have kind of fallen apart, and they kind of have to find each other again. So it's a bromance, and it's also a murder mystery.
Yeah, and I'll get to the bromance thing in a minute, but of all the people to turn into detectives, why Joe Biden and Barack Obama? Where did the idea come from?
You know, you look at Joe Biden and you see his aviator shades. He looks like a James Bond or Tom Cruise in Top Gun or something. And then he opens his mouth and he's more like Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Naked Gun or something, and you go, oh, that's not what I was expecting. Now, you know, I know the real Joe Biden's actually much more serious than the one in the public eye, but I always wanted to do a story about him just as a detective with some kind of, you know, murder mystery going in his head the whole time as he's vice president. But then I realized, you know, it doesn't really work without Barack Obama there, who's sort of the brains behind the operation. He's the one who's kind of the Sherlock. And as soon as I said, oh, it's Sherlock and Watson, everything really clicked into place. I mean, you know, I'm like, Sherlock and Watson were the original bromance in terms of mysteries and thrillers, and people have been ripping them off for 100 years. I was like, what's one more ripoff, you know?
Yeah, and see, you got Sherlock, and what I got was basically, okay, Bogart and Dr. Wu. Because I couldn't figure out. No, from the moment Obama stepped in, you're thinking, okay, here comes Humphrey Bogart. You know, he's got the cigarette thing going off, and boom, there he is. And Biden, it's just like you described. He has that kind of, he's investigating something. He's got his own ideas, man, and he's going ahead with it, but he's still treated like, you know, second fiddle.
Yeah, and that comes up a lot in the book, is he feels like he's second fiddle, and, you know, they have to come to a realization that, hey, you know, we're not in office anymore, you know, we're equals, and he thinks, you know, if I'm ever going to get to be president, I have to step outside of this guy's shadow. And I think these are questions that you wouldn't expect to really see addressed in a book that's just a straight-up joke.
Yeah.
It was a surprise to me how serious things started to get once I started writing it. But once I did, you know, my editor was like, I want more of this. This is the really affecting stuff. This is good stuff. I was like, really? I've never really tried to, you know, be earnest before. But, you know, as I get older, I expect to become more and more earnest until I'm eventually just a, you know, humorless corpse or something.
So. Oh, wow, that is sad.
Oh, is that too dark? Sorry, I was just getting too much into this Joe Biden character. He talks about mortality a lot in the book.
Yeah, and, you know, I also got really sad when he and Obama, you know, I won't give too much away, but when they had to kind of part ways for, you know, the time. But it still brought a smile to my face reading about these guys just acting like regular people, you know?
That's good, yeah. I wanted to really humanize these characters, and they are characters because they're not the real guys, but really humanize them in a way that, you know, maybe people haven't seen. And I've actually had people, you know, that are more of a conservative persuasion, we'll call them family, you know, that have read this book and, you know, have said, oh, it's, you know, that's not as bad as I thought it would be. They're
right.
Just real people. And I'm like, see, they're just real people, you know. We're all in this together, so, but that was one of the things I tried to do, was give them a small crime to work on so that it doesn't really overtake the characters or the bromance that's going on, and it really sort of gives it a little bit of a spine, but it doesn't overtake things.
Right. Now, in your writing, how do you navigate the challenges of making people who are not generally funny into characters that make us smile and laugh?
It was really just about building up their characters and then playing them off each other, because anytime you have two people who are antagonists, mm-hmm. who are just, you know, almost the opposite, even though they're on the same political spectrum, they're just very different from each other. So anytime you have people who are different, it's very fun and it's very easy to get them to fight.
Right.
And part of the joy there is that I think people have, you know, knew for a long time that, oh, as soon as you saw these two guys get together during the first campaign in 2008, you go, oh, like after, it was like one day before Joe said something that had Obama like shaking his head in public or something, you know, it's like, yeah. Oh my God, this is never going to work. And then you saw them become friends over time. So, you know, it, the idea that people can disagree on stuff and still be friends is almost a novel concept now.
Right.
And it was just something that I wanted to really bring out in these characters, to have them go at each other, but then also, you know, have them hug it out afterwards. And I think, you know, it's no surprise that, like I said, I reviewed romance novels, and I wrote a romance novel parody, and I used a romance novel structure on this book.
Right.
Okay. You know, which is towards the end of the book, you split them up, and then you have them come back together stronger than before.
Right. Now, before we get any farther, Andrew, will you share with our audience where they can find out more about your work?
Oh, sure. They can find out more about this book at hopeneverdies.us.
Thank you for that. Now, I have just a couple more questions for you. Have you had any feedback from Obama and Biden about this book?
I haven't had any feedback from them, but I did meet Biden on his book tour last year. I had like a VIP ticket, and I was going to say something to him about it. But the thing is, when you get that close to Joe Biden, he just overwhelms you with his Bidenism. You know, he's just he's larger than life, and he's right there, and he's smiling, and he's shaking your hand, and there's just not – you just can't say anything, you know? It's just, he was everything I wanted, though, because I had a picture of an ice cream cone on my shirt because I thought he would enjoy it. But he looks right at it, and he goes, "Ice cream, that's my favorite."
Yeah.
You know, okay. I was just like, wow, you are, he's at once, he's a caricature, but then you try to imagine what's behind that smile. You know, he's had a tough life.
Yeah.
And he's also had a magical life. So it's just such an interesting character.
Yeah, and you know, you actually brought some things to my mind, and I don't know how this worked for other readers, but I was wondering if you might be considering getting Margaret Thatcher, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama back in there, and maybe Joe Biden even, and have a Scooby-Doo type agency with these guys. You can rent out Lassie or something.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that there is a sequel in the works called Hope Rides Again, and I'm currently working on it. It's going to be set in Chicago, and it stars both Barack and Joe. You know, I hope to see some other characters in there as well. Everybody's been telling me, is Oprah going to be in there?
And I thought about just, that.
I'm just going to have to leave you hanging on that right now because it's classified.
Okay, I can accept that. But our time is running out. Andrew, thank you so much for stopping by and speaking with us today.
Oh, no problem. It's my pleasure, Emmanuel.
All right. I'll be looking forward to the next book, man, and hopefully we can talk again.
All right. Thank you. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Andrew Schaefer. More at hopeneverdies.us. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program now, music from the Commodores in conversation with original and current member William King, a.k.a. Whack. We may hear those interchanged throughout the conversation. I have this opportunity to ask about Sail On and Easy and Three Times Lady, Brick House, all that stuff. And there's always something that ends up coming from left field. And in this case, I just read that you considered playing tennis professionally after college before continuing on with the Commodores. Did you still play here and there in the early days of the Commodores?
I did. I absolutely did. It didn't last much longer. You know, I played in college, and I won the SIAC championships.
Oh, nice.
Which is Southern Division. And then from that, I got a couple of cards where I could play some satellite tournaments. So I thought at the time that, you know, I was trying to make up my mind which way I wanted to go. But I had started tennis too late. You know, you need to really start when you're probably around 4 or 5 years old. And I started when I was in college. So even though I picked the sport up very quickly and was fairly good at it, I decided that I could play tennis and still have my career in music, because it wouldn't have worked in reverse. I couldn't have been a tennis player and have music.
Right. Well, since the Commodores came together in college, was it purely an instrumental group, the two groups, what was it, the Jays and the Mystics, I think, coming together? Was it initially meant to be an instrumental group, and then the songs started happening after that?
Well, the Commodores was an instrumental group. We started out just playing music for James Brown, top 10, top 40, whatever you want to call it. We'd have people come over and they would sing. None of us in the group were singing at the time. Even Richie wasn't singing. Richie played saxophone in the band. Never sang one song. And then we were actually picked up by another group that had broken up. They were called the Jays. They had broken up. Some of their members had had a fight, or, you know, how bands do. And so they wanted to merge what was left of Jays with, we call ourselves the Mystics. So we said, fine, you know, because the Jays were, at that time, the hot band in the area. They were the band that when something came up, everybody wanted them to play it. When something major came up. So, yeah, we merged with them. And then we wanted a different name. And so we got the name Commodores that merged the two groups together.
All right. People can name all the songs. Some of the ones that I named just a moment ago, people can name all the songs that became hit after hit after hit. But then you look at things like Machine Gun. If you caught the Soul Train performance, that's you on congas on that particular TV performance, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. You played whatever was in front of you. You know, everybody played a couple of different instruments, some more than a couple. Whatever was needed. You know, and it didn't even matter what you played on the record. You know what I mean? Because once you do the record and then you get horns put on it and you get strings put on it and then you have extra this, extra that, extra guitar part. So maybe, you know, your main instrument might be keyboards, but there's a guitar part that's a main line and the guitar player already has a part he's playing, so you could just play the guitar part. It just depended on what the song needed as to what instrument you played.
Gotcha. Yeah, between old videos or liner notes here and there, you mentioned Lionel Richie on saxophone. People would think of him as a vocalist. You catch him on keyboards also. Again, it depends on which song it is.
Yeah, it just depends on what song it was and what was needed. My main instrument at the time was trumpet and then keyboards. And later on, I started banging on guitar. And Richie played keyboards and saxophone. Marlon played keyboards, guitar, bass guitar, and drums. We were all over the place. Each guy played more than one instrument.
That's one of the cool things about looking at the Commodores. Again, whether it's the videos or listening to the records or checking out the liner notes like I do, it's nice to see the big change up. Oh, and now before we go too far, speaking of Soul Train, did you ever look at the old videos and think that you were much taller back then?
Well, I always think I'm taller. Back then and now, okay?
Okay. All right. I always thought it'd be funny to find out without the heels and the hair, you were all like 5'5" or something like that.
Now, we were taller than that, but... I mean, Ronald was the bass player, was 6'4".
Oh, my gosh.
But then you had Walter, which was 5'4".
Okay, so, full range.
So we had the full range there, I got to tell you.
Yeah, you did. Now, growing up, I have to admit, I was one of those strange kids who noticed interesting instrumentals, you know, in the middle of other vocal tracks. And I think I was enjoying Rapid Fire before I was even truly conscious of the word instrumental. It was really refreshing to find bands that were putting out instrumentals. In the world of pop music, it's mostly vocal works. So you guys slowly shifted to just being a vocal powerhouse group.
We actually cut our teeth on doing instrumentals. That's how we cut our teeth.
Some of my favorite stuff.
You know, and it wasn't until much later when we got a manager that he said, you know what, you guys need to sing yourselves. And that's when we started trying to whoever sing what. And again, it was based on what we had, who could sing it the best.
Again, you see some of the different guys coming forward on different vocals. And speaking of which, one of them, Brick House. Wasn't it your wife that coined the phrase Brick House?
No, it was actually Walter Orange, the guy that actually sung the song.
Ah, okay.
Coined the phrase. But my wife at the time was the one, she wrote lyrics for it. Yeah, I went home. It was supposed to be Walter and I was supposed to write the lyrics for the song. And I went home, and I had played that track. At that time, it was on cassette. So I had played that poor little cassette over and over and over. Finally, she said, look, you know what? Please turn that off. You know, because I've heard that song. She said, if you don't know that song by now, by memory, then there's something wrong with you. And so I actually fell asleep with the writing pad on my chest. And when I woke up the next morning, most of the lyrics were written, and she had written them and just put them on my chest so that she wouldn't have to hear that track again.
That is funny. You set to write the song, put it down, and she finished it while you were asleep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When I woke up, the lyrics were literally on my chest. The pad was on my chest, not just left in the bed. And I thought, these are the best lyrics I ever wrote in my life.
It's one thing to wake up with an epiphany of something that you ought to write, but to have it already written down for you, that's all the better.
That's all the better.
Yeah.
There's no guesswork in that.
That's William King from the Commodores at the L.A. County Fair soon. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
You have said that, by the way, Brick House is not about one girl, but really it's about any girl, any type of person. It's just really about who you're thinking about when that song is going on.
Sail on down the line about half a mile or so, and don't really want to know where you're going. Maybe once or twice you see, time after time I try to hold on to what we got, but now you're going.
Now, Sail On the other hand, another huge, huge hit, bunch of ballads in the Commodores' works. This was one of the big ones. I probably listened to this one 100 times before realizing it was amongst the more fun breakup songs you can find out there.
Here's the thing. We had just done some things with Kenny Rogers. We had been around Kenny Rogers. And so it was kind of like we wanted to do something in that country feel. And we were getting a lot of flack from a lot of people around us because they were saying, you know, you don't need to write anything country. You know, you're not a country band. You need to stick to what you know. And I thought, well, wait a minute. We can write anything we want to write. It just has to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key to any song. Is it good? And that's the way we were with most of our music, is that we just threw a lot of things into the pot. And what came out, well, you know, that's what it was. So we had, like, Ronald was a funk bass player. We had Violin, who was jazz and blues. You had Richie and myself, which was more contemporary, more modern, also more ballad and up-tempo pop song. And then you had the guitar player, who was rock and roll, acid. He loved Jimi Hendrix.
Nice.
And then you had the drummer, which was Walter, the guy that actually sung Brick House. He was big band. He loved jazz and big band. So our music spectrum was all over the place. So people bringing in things that was very different. And we would put a blues part in where there was a ballad part and a rock and roll part and a jazz part and whatever we thought fit, it was fine with us. So what you got was what they now consider the Commodore sound. It was just a conglomeration of a lot of different music thrown into the pot to pull out one type.
Just stirred together. Sounds like a good gumbo.
It was a good gumbo. And so that's how Sail On was basically made. And there are a lot of different things in the background of that song that's mixed down low that people don't necessarily readily hear, but they can feel them. And we like doing that, putting certain different type sounds in music. Not trying to trick people, but, you know, people say, I don't understand how you could put a certain type of rhythm to it and we not know it. But we do that in our music all over the place.
It means that we all need to go back and take a second and third and fifth and tenth listen to all of these tunes.
Well, you know what I love about our music, though?
What's that?
How simplistic it was. When I listen to other bands' music, which they have like 45 different things going on at the same time, you know, or 10 different things. In most of our music, we don't. We have a basic rhythm track with a couple of overdubs in it. But granted now, it didn't start out like that. I mean, most of our music, it was so many people laying so many parts on it. That there were, like everybody, we had 40 or 50 parts. But those parts clash a lot of times. You know, when you get the playback, you can hear them hitting against each other and you just snatch them out. And you know, people say, wait a minute, that's the part I put on there. And you say, yeah, but it's clash. So a lot of times we had to take a vote to take people's parts out. So they were upset, you know, that part they played was being snatched out.
On any of the biggest hits that you had out there, can you think of any examples where, like your horn section, maybe your part on the trumpet, or Richie's section on the sax, where that was pulled out?
That was always done. Oh, yeah, okay. Without a doubt. Especially in the very beginning when we were doing that very first album, there were a lot of horn parts that were snatched out. And even in Brick House, there were parts that were taken out horn-wise. They were just a little bit too cluttered.
Thanks for the times that you've given.
But, you know, the good part about it is that when you're sitting in that room and you've had one or two days rest away from the song and you play that song back, it sounds totally different from when you left it. You know, the mix is different. And, you know, if you mix a song at, say, 4 a.m. in the morning and you've been in the studio all day and all night, man, you'd be amazed at the amount of highs that are on that song. Because, you know, your ears start going dead, and so you don't hear the highs as well. So when you're mixing, you're turning up more highs so you can hear them. But the next day when your ears have rested and you hear it, you go, my God, who mixed this? So, yeah, there are so many things that we have put in, you know, but we take out. Because you just need a day or two to rest and hear it back, and you really get the real, real song.
I would imagine there's so much of a subjective feel to it, too. You mentioned being in the studio all day, you're tired, and maybe one song might not sound so good, but that's only because you're exhausted.
Yeah, and so that has happened. I mean, we had one song, and I'm not going to tell you which one it is.
Uh-oh.
But the song had 100-and-something takes. I mean, just to get the rhythm flat down. 100-and-something takes. Now, we were so embarrassed by that that we actually asked Sal Harris, the engineer at the time, to erase the take number. Because she said at the beginning of the take, she said, take one, take two, take three. You know, so we got him to take the 100-and-something take. We just had to ask to take that off. Because we did not want anybody to know at the time that we had taken that many times to get the song to where we wanted it to be.
So were we this close to getting 123 times a lady?
I tell you, I won't tell which song it was. But I can tell you this, it was 100 plus. I can tell you that.
Beautiful, beautiful.
William King from the Commodores at the LA County Fair soon. I'm David Fleming. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to music from the Commodores in conversation with original and current member William A. King, or WAC for short. The Commodores will be at the LA County Fair soon. Now, most of the hits that you guys had went across at least a couple of charts. On the dance charts now, Do the Bump. This is one that I suppose may be lesser known than some of the others, but it charted. I have to ask, as far as a timing situation, were people calling it the bump and then you sang about it, or did people start bumping to the song you did? And I do mean to infer dancing.
That's a good question.
Yeah, chicken or the
egg?
Actually,
I'm not sure, because the song was written by Marlon Williams, the keyboard player. And he brought the song in. Do the bump, baby.
Uh-huh.
And he brought that song in. And we started tinkering around with it a lot. And I would assume the bump was already happening. It was just starting, because we would not have done a song to be on the end of something. I don't think that we originated the dance, the bump. Uh-huh. I don't remember that happening. But I tell you this, it took off overseas and Japan, especially in the eastern countries. It went to number one, I think. It just took off. And we actually did a tour of Asia based on that song.
Oh, wow. That was actually one of the songs that U.S. charts, U.K. charts, dance charts, and just all the way across down the list of them.
It did extremely well for us overseas. It wasn't as big here like some of the other songs were, of course, but overseas it was a huge hit for us. And it's funny because when we go overseas a lot of times, people will ask us to play the bump. And songs like The Bump, Young Girls Are My Weakness, which were not big hits in the States but did well overseas.
Trying to get and, close to you and stuff
and,
like
and,
that.
Yeah, but the funny part about this is we don't remember how to play those songs. Seriously, we don't know the lyrics to most of those songs anymore, because we put a show together and this show is based around 20 or 21 songs that we had huge hits out of, and that were straight across the board, across the world, like Breakout Through Translation, Deal East Close to Sweet Love, Night Shift, Sail On, songs like that. And so those songs are not in that category. And so we just say, oh, we're so sorry, we just wanted to show tonight. But the truth is, we couldn't play them if we tried, probably.
You heard it here first, folks. That's nice. I promise you, that's not an edit point. That's staying in. Okay. Well, Wack, you mentioned Night Shift, so now we're into the mid-80s by now for Night Shift. I would not have guessed that this was, for the most part, the same vocalist as Brickhouse. We're talking Walter Orange there.
Oh, yeah.
This is quite a difference between the style of delivery on Brickhouse, the soul funk thing, and a beautiful ballad tribute to both Marvin Gaye and Jackie Wilson with nods in the lyrics. Oh, and this is wonderful to point out, too, with all respect to Lionel Richie and all, this was the Commodores' first Grammy, despite all the hits. This was the first Grammy you guys got.
Yeah, it's the first one. And we're angry about it, too.
Never going to, 40 years later. No, nah, we're not bitter.
You know, you got songs like Sweet Love, Close to You, they were all known. Sweet Love, Close to You, Brick House, Lady, You Bring Me Up. And like I said, the list goes, I can't even think of them all right now. But, you know, the bottom line is that none of those songs won. But at last, we won with Night Shift. But, you know, Walter sung on a lot of the earlier songs, like Sweet Love, you know. But, you know, he has that type of voice where he can go more melodic than he does funky or rhythmic. He has the ability to change his voice like that. And a lot of songs that he sung back in the day, people thought that Richie sung them. And that disturbs him a bit, you know.
Sure.
He never fails to correct people when he finds out that they say something like that, which, you know, I understand. I mean, you know, if I sung something and they've given credit to someone else, I too would feel like they need to be corrected.
Sure.
But he jumps at it. But no, it really wasn't something that he had not done in the past, or was something that was, you know, away from what he normally does. He had been doing it all along. And he has a beautiful falsetto, and he also can be very, very melodic when he needs to be. Not just a rough version of James Brown or a very up-tempo funk part of Brickhouse.
Oh, nice way of putting that. Regarding Night Shift, was this one brought to the table by Orange and others, or was it maybe a group decision to make a tribute to these guys, both having died in 1984? How did this song come about for the Commodores?
Well, you know, it was kind of a little of all of that. Originally, when that song was brought in, and actually, it doesn't sound anything like what the original song brought in, uh-huh. I don't think. It was an Oh Baby song.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? Oh Baby,
sure.
You know, Baby, I Love You, Baby, Be My Baby, that kind of song.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't
imagine.
That
kind of song. But Clyde, we call him Clyde, but Walter kept coming in talking about Marvin Gaye's death, and he just couldn't stop. I mean, it bothered him a lot. So finally, you know, we said to him, you know what, why don't you just write a song about Marvin? I mean, we all miss him, but, you know, you really are taken by this. So he actually got with the producer at the time, Fanny Gold, I think her name was, another writer, and they put the song together and brought it back into us, and we loved it. We loved it from the first moment you heard it. And that's usually the way it is with our hit songs. When you hear it, everybody in the room nods their head and go, yeah, that's the one we need to put out.
But imagine it's something you're just feeling.
Yeah, and then once the track was done, and that track rolled back across those speakers, it was magic. You know, with that off synthesizer, the bass off, it was magic. We loved it, and it was a huge hit right away for us.
I don't know if this is a rumor or a misprint, but I have to ask you about it. In 1991, you were trying to put together a greatest hits album, but Motown refused the rights to the original masters. Do I understand it correctly that you just re-recorded the songs with different vocalists and new arrangements?
Because Motown had the rights to those masters, to the original masters that we cut back in the late 70s.
Right.
And everything had to go through them. We decided that we didn't want to do that anymore. So we actually went in the studio. We went back and got the same instruments, and we went back in the studio and recorded note for note the way that they were originally recorded, including the strings. And then we did the vocals. And we had studied those vocals to make sure that they were like the ones that were on the original tracks. The exception was is that James Nicholas was singing the part that Richie was singing. But we had him to do his phrasing like Richie. Now, normally, we would not have done that. You know, you kind of let people do what they want to do, you know, their own feelings.
Sure.
But this wasn't about a personal vocal arrangement here. This was about copying as best we could material that we had already recorded. So we wanted it to be identical. So now we own the masters to all of our recordings that we re-recorded so that we don't have to go through Motown unless we want to.
Okay. We were talking about the different instruments that all of the guys in the band play, and so I know with guitar anyway, I guess this goes back to McCleary leaving, replaced by Sheldon Reynolds. Then when he left for Earth, Wind & Fire, then you stepped up for guitar from the trumpet position. But what this is really leading to is I want to know how many instruments you play.
Basically, the trumpet, keyboard, and guitar. And I like to play congas and rhythm instruments. I like to play a lot of the rhythm. So I guess that's four. I like to play rhythmic stuff. No reed instruments. Actually, there is a video out that has me playing saxophone. And that was because when we were doing the video, we were going to have another guy play the saxophone. The guy didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
So we were stuck there with no one to play the saxophone.
So are you just basically lip-syncing the saxophone? Are you miming?
Yeah, I'm lip-syncing the saxophone, yeah, in the video. I'm just fine. Just J-Ball. It's okay. I don't care.
Oh, boy. We're going to have to track that one down. That's great. Wow.
That's William King from the Commodores at the L.A. County Fair soon. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
When we see you guys on stage nowadays, do we get to see you pick up the guitar and then put it down and pick up the trumpet and then switch over the congas or whatever? Or do you pretty much stay on the guitar through the sets?
No, you see me going back and forth between a lot of stuff. Keyboard, guitar, trumpet. I'm not doing any rhythm instruments in this particular show, but yeah, I go back and forth. I think I'm the only one that doesn't leave the stage.
You're one of the few that never left the Commodores.
Exactly. But yeah, and I tell you, we just have such a good time. It's three Commodores now. With Walter Orange, James Nicholas, and myself. And we have five band members, which we call the Mean Machine.
The Mean Machine, yes. And I have to know, are these a consistent bunch of guys, or is this basically the name of whatever group that's backing you three?
Some of the guys, we've had guys that go in and out. We've had some of the guys come in, go out, and come back. But, and we lost one of the guys that had been with us like 35, 38 years.
Oh, my gosh.
He died. Harold Hudson. He was about music director for the band. And we've known him ever since we were in college together. He went to Alabama State, which is like 20 minutes down the street from Tuskegee, where we went to college. And he grew up as a very good friend of ours. And he was an incredible musician, but he died about 5-6 years ago, had a heart attack. But yeah, most of the band members some of them have been with us 20, almost 30 years. We have one guy that's the lead guitar player with, probably been with us maybe 2 years now. So we have some members that have been here quite a long time, which is great because that's the stability of the band.
Sometimes when you see a band and you wonder, well, that's not whatever, the original bass player. But I mean, in y'all's case, even if it's not the original, we're still talking about someone who's been with you 25, 35 years. So
yeah,
they're still the veteran.
And here's the other thing. The bass player that's playing in the band, he's from Tuskegee, Alabama.
Oh,
he literally
gosh.
Grew up. He grew up under us. I mean, he came to our rehearsals. He was in another band, but he stuck around us all the time. He was around Ronald, which was the original bass player. And Ronald and he played together all the time. It's just as a matter of fact, when Ronald comes back from New Zealand, they still get together. They just got together about 3 weeks ago because he still lives in Tuskegee, Alabama, and Ronald goes back to Tuskegee to see his family. And so they get together and jam. He actually knows the feel probably as well as Ronald because he grew up with Ronald playing the same part.
Maybe even better than Ronald. He had to learn the parts, and so he probably picked it up from the records, note for note.
He actually picked them up from Ronald, because he and Ronald were playing together.
Oh, yeah, they're in the garage.
Yeah, so, like I said, he grew up in the Commodores. He was one of the kids that grew up around us and with us. We had many guys like that. We had guys that grew up in our crew that we taught from Tuskegee, Alabama, that one of them went on to become our stage manager. And then when we went off the road, he became Madonna's stage manager and Earth, Wind & Fire stage manager.
Oh, wow.
So we had a few people to come up with us that we taught how to do other jobs around us. They've gone on to do other things with other groups.
couple more things for you before I have to let you go. But Cebu, one could say it's an island province off the Philippines.
That's correct.
You know, another, you could also say it's another instrumental that I noted early on, I suppose. This is when I was doing contemporary jazz and funk on the radio, another NPR place way back when. I could never get more straight from the horse's mouth as this. So I just have to ask you, what is it named for?
The name is just the name of the island. We were there. We went to Cebu. And when we were there, it was a very rural at the time. I expect it still is. I mean, rural to the point where people didn't live in houses. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure that there were houses there, as we played there. But a lot of the people didn't even live in houses. They lived in the trees. They had these cardboard boxes around trees. They lived in the hillsides. It was very hilly there. We rolled in and these government trucks, and we had the army, they had the Philippine army with us, took us over there. And these people were running out of the hills down to the trucks that we were traveling in with albums and Commodore 45. And that was no electricity there. And that has always amazed us. There was no electricity. So we kept thinking, how are they playing these records?
Uh-huh.
You know? So we asked the military to stop the trucks and all, and we literally got out and signed their albums and autographs. No, we just stopped along the roadside. That inspired us to do the song that's called Cebu, because those people were so wonderful. We named the song after them.
All right.
Yeah.
I half expected just a very brief, almost dismissive answer. This is a really cool answer. That's fantastic.
Nah. You know, most of the songs and all that we write come from something. They come from something. You know, it's like I wrote this song called Young Girls My Weakness one time. And I was on an elevator, and it was jam-packed. I mean, literally jam-packed. Mm-hmm. And the elevator doors opened up, and this beautiful girl was standing there. And it was not a space for her to get on. But all of these guys just pushed back to make space for this woman to get on this elevator. Okay? So she gets on the elevator, and the doors close. And you can hardly breathe because everybody's pressing in on your chest, your back, your side. Mm-hmm. And she had more space than she needed up there. Okay? So, and there was this old man that was right behind me, and he had a cane. And he was just tapping the floor of the elevator. He was pushing, and he was trying to look over my shoulder. And I turned around. I looked at him. I said, you know what? Young girls are your weakness. And so when the doors opened, we all got off. And I thought, young girls are my weakness. I just like the sweetness. And then stuff just started coming. Yeah, and I went home and wrote the song, Young Girls Are My Weakness. It was about the old man on the elevator with that young girl up in the front.
Wow.
So that's just how we write. I mean, it's always a story. I don't think there's any that just, you know, just haphazardly happen.
Just something happens and write it down before you forget.
And write it down before you forget. Especially now.
Especially now.
At 6 to 6 now, you better write it down pretty quick.
Like the stadiums, seeing the literal sea of faces out there, or the theater shows where you can actually see the faces?
I like both. I gotta tell you, it's like asking whether you like barbecue or hot dogs. You know what I mean? They both have their place.
Yeah, okay.
I love the intimacy when you play a small theater because the people are right there. And I'm telling you, and you can literally, I mean, feel them, okay? And you can hear them singing right through yourself. I mean, the vibration is right there. And they just sing along with those songs. And I'm always amazed by the fact that they know all the lyrics of so many of the songs. A lot of the songs of their lives. I mean, they happened to a certain part of their life that was very, very important to them. But I like the big places, too, because the vastness. I love playing and just seeing all the people out there. And the roar that comes back from that crowd, literally can almost knock you off the stage. It's so strong. So they both have their place.
All right. Still break out the instrumental funk jams in the middle of a set, or you rely pretty much on those 20 songs that we were discussing before?
it goes back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes we do that. But, you know, especially when we play larger places. But when we play smaller arenas or playhouses or whatever you want to call them, that's 3,500, that's 5,000 or 6,000 seater, those people are there for the most part. They just want to hear the song. They want to hear those songs exactly the way they heard them because they can reminisce right now, right away. And they don't want to be taken out of that because when you break off into an ad lib part, it departs from the song itself. And it's like when we do Three Times and Still and Easy, Close to You, those songs. You know, people are literally waiting for the next part of that song. And they don't want you to deviate from that because their minds are already set. So when you get there, they don't want to have to stop and listen to something else. They want to sing that song all the way through because that's what they've done for the past 35 or 40 years. And that's what they did with their lover or girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever.
Mm. As a musician, there's got to be a bit of a struggle, I suppose, between wanting to break out, maybe some improvisation, but then also wanting and needing to deliver the song that you know the people are there for.
Yeah. And you know, here's the thing about improvisation. You know, when we get together, we jam all the time. We jam in sound check. So we're able to blow off that steam. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you can vent.
Gotcha.
You can vent then, and plus it's a lot of creative juices there that we can actually take from to create a new song. We do that a lot in sound check. Sometimes so much so that we have to reel ourselves back in to get a sound check.
Oops. Stop with the fun for a second.
Yeah. But I think the thing that I love the most is that I don't think any of us ever get tired of playing those songs, those same songs, every night. And I think that's rare because, I've known other bands that have said that they weren't even going to play any of their old songs. They were only going to play the new songs on the new album.
Ooh,
and then would go out to tour. People got word of it. They said, well, but that's why they come out to see you. You know, as much as you may think that they love you personally, you know, it really is about the music. I mean, if people know that they're not going to hear Three Times and Steal and Easy, you know, Brick House, what's the point of coming?
Well, I'd be there for the sound check. I want the instrumental jams.
Yeah, but you have a different set of mind.
Yeah, I've been told that. Yeah.
Than the audience is. You know what I mean? So you're like me. You know, you're coming from a total music aspect of it. And the music is the end game for you.
Hmm.
For them, it's a lot about reminiscing. It's a lot about being taken back to those times when things were very, very wonderful, or to a time where something was very soft, but the music aided them and helped them to get out of it.
They want that greatest hits album or the back seat at the drive-in or whatever the case was.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah.
Music from the Commodores in conversation with William King. The Commodores will be at the L.A. County Fair August 31st. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to William King, to Emmanuel Rogers, and to author Andrew Schaefer. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, Jessica Greenwell, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.